Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Mr. Mark Rice and Mr. Sharon Bowie. Mr. Bowie, Mark was telling me during the break that you have a very compelling story. I didn't ask you whether or not you had ever been incarcerated and why you knew so much about incarceration. Are you willing to share a little bit about your story?
Absolutely, sir. You know, I believe that anything that's held in the dark, if you put in the light, it could be of benefit. So if you'd like,
yes, sir.
I'll be more than happy to.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
I was incarcerated in the Wisconsin Department of Corrections for the crime of first-degree intentional homicide. I served 25 consecutive years in prison. Specifically, you know, it was one of those situations where I pleaded no contest to the crime because I was filled with naivete. That's the only offense that I've ever committed in my life, and of course, it's a big one. Some of the particulars are a friend of mine who, for whatever reason, we had a conflict, and throughout the course of that conflict, I killed my friend. I was guilty of that. I acknowledged that, and I felt that the honorable thing to do would be to accept the punishment for that. I did not know, though, that there were different degrees, that there were different circumstances. This was not explained to me at the time when I accepted that punishment. Nonetheless, I served the 25 years. Some of the things in particular that I think are important is that both the judge and the district attorney, as well as other societal stakeholders, believe that I should be released from prison if, you know, I comported myself in a proper way after serving 13 years, 4 months. I served that time period, and then on November 1st, 2007, the district attorney, Judy Schwamley, she wrote the parole commission, informed them of what the judge dictated, what she had said, et cetera. Then she wrote them again in 2009 to inquire why I had not been released, and then, of course, she died. And from 2007 to 2020, I served that time in the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. During that time period, several things of significance happened. For instance, I earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, assisted over 300 men in obtaining their high school diplomas. As the production clerk, earned $3 million+ while implementing some supply chain management techniques. I actually signed up 14 individuals to the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. I was apprentice veteran service representative, and I won 7 cases, specifically 7 service-connected disability cases for veterans who are incarcerated. I actually founded American Legion Post 1998, the first American Legion Post in prison.
So you're a veteran?
Yes, sir. I'm a 100% service-connected former United States Marine, and my service had a direct correlation to the events that gave rise to that conflict on August 2nd, 1992. So there's a lot of things to unpack and untangled with my story, and I don't necessarily mind unpacking them and untangling them, but I just give you an overview of why I sometimes sound the way I sound and think the way I think and feel the way that I feel. And to, again, marry on to, or to jump on what Mark said, I, too, have been diagnosed with various Axis I disorders. Specifically, I have post-traumatic stress disorder with a panic anxiety disorder, major depression, recurrent type. And I believe those diagnoses, and that when you read the DSM-5, the characteristics that comprise those diagnoses, I have them. And as a result of me taking some time to get to know myself and actually working towards myself, I was able to address some of those issues, and I'm working to continue to address those issues even today. As things stand now, I have a master's degree like Mark, and I am pursuing a doctorate from Bradley University.
It is so wonderful a story. Because life doesn't end when you first go in, right? I mean, that for far too many people, they say, well, you know, I'm in, I'm tagged, I'm a felon. Because I'm a felon, my life is over. And the fact that you and Mark and many others have been able to overcome that. I'm not saying that people are individuals and people have different capacities and capabilities and we're all different. But there is, and it can happen because you guys are testaments that, you know, the life can be changed, right?
Absolutely, sir. And for me, however, you know, once again, you are very profoundly insightful because your statement of, you know, your life being over when I first went in, you know, I thought that I would work and work and work and work and then ultimately be released. And then ultimately after that day when those letters and then I was denied and denied and denied. And then most importantly, when those who I love began to die. When my father died, when my nephew died, when my friends died, right. When my only child died, you know, it's a devastating thing. I've every day it strikes me, you know, the last time I saw my only child was, you know, laying in a coffin while I'm there surrounded by guards. And this was 11 years after I was supposed to have been released, when I had done everything that I was supposed to have done and more. And, you know, I thought I could work my way out of prison. I thought I could earn my way out of prison, and it didn't happen. And so, you know, you reach that point where you can either take the road less traveled, right, where you continue to work and strive to do good for your macro and micro environment, or you can just say, hey, I'm turning to the left, and I'm going to go ahead and engage in the behavior of those in my immediate surroundings. And that's a difficult choice to make. And I think that I made the right choices. I dedicated my life, myself, the remainder of my life to making sure that my daughter has a father that she can be proud of. And that every day that I live, I will live it as happily as I can for every day that my daughter was unhappy. And that's the decision that I made, the choice that I made. And that's why I'm here speaking to you right now.
So let's talk about the debate that we've got. A gubernatorial, you know, election coming up very soon. And we do know that, and it's, you know, it's clear where Republicans have wanted to take the state and where they've taken it. When it comes to incarceration, it is a buzzword. It certainly incites people, and you can hear it when you hear conservative talk radio. It's always crime, and even areas where people don't see much crime, they're inundated with the candidates talking about, well, the crime is coming, as if the crime is coming to a place near you, you know. And there are people who are afraid in this country, and they don't know. They can't connect dots. They just hear the crime is coming. So let's talk about the debate that you guys are organizing and putting together, and what your thoughts are.
Sure, I can go over the United States Senate Candidate Forum again. Wisdom's going to be hosting.
Oh, it's the Senate.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
U.S. Senate Candidate Forum. That'll be Thursday, July 21st, starting at 8:15 p.m. And we have Mandela Barnes coming. Tom Nelson will
be
there.
Lieutenant Governor.
Yes, and Sarah Godlewski. They've all agreed to participate. Alex Lazary.
State Treasurer.
And Ron Johnson have been invited, but have not committed,
said anything yet.
Committed to participating at this point. And so we're going to be lifting up federal issues like restoring the right to vote and Justice Reinvestment Act. We want to, but it's tied to state level. So federal and state are definitely tied. We know going back to the 94 crime bill had a huge impact on Wisconsin. It's tied to what candidates for governor are doing as well here. Republican candidates want to build a new prison in Green Bay as part of their platform. They want to close the current Green Bay Correctional Institution, do economic development projects on that land, and then build a bigger prison that'll have increase their capacity to incarcerate people in Green Bay. And we need to push back on that. And they're using scare tactics. We've seen around the old law parole issue that they're using these tactics that people who could be released on parole are just waiting to get out to commit violent acts and terrorize the community. We know that's not true. We have stories like my story, Sharon's story, but many others. There's not been one single high-profile case of anybody being released on parole in Wisconsin and committing some sort of heinous crime. And we know that the evidence suggests that people who have done more than 20 years in prison are rarely, they rarely return to prison for a new serious crime. And people tend to age out of crime. The Sentencing Project, for example, has been advocating for caps on sentences at 20 years. And in European nations, they've started to do that, and they're producing better outcomes than the United States. And we got to look up front again with the Justice Reinvestment Act. We need to, instead of building more prisons, we need to start to decarcerate. Wisconsin can reduce the prison population by expanding treatment alternatives to incarceration, by giving people a fair chance to be released on parole, by ending crimeless revocations. The governor can commute sentences in cases. There's so many people that have been sentenced unfairly in this state. We have to look at the huge racial injustice, the impact, the disproportionate impact on Black and Brown and Native communities in this state. And so there's so many opportunities where we could actually be decarcerated and closing prisons and instead putting that money back into the communities that have been most devastated by incarceration. And that's going to change everything. But we need that vision. We need to get the U.S. Senate candidates on board. We need to get legislation at the federal level. We need the governor to start pushing more boldly in this state, and we need the legislature to come around here, which is going to be long term. We know where the legislature's at, but we're going to continue to fight and push back on the narrative that's being pushed out there by some candidates who are distorting the truth.
You know, the value of having all this white hair that I have is I remember Boxerville, whatever it is, when they built that prison. When they built that prison and all the money that went into that prison, and even to this day, there's only a handful of people there. And the fact that we are even talking about building another prison, for some of us understand that when they build those prisons and where they build them, communities spring up around them. And listen, we got to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. My guests are Mark Rice and Mr. Sharon Bowie, and they've got some very compelling information to bring to you. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guests are Mr. Sharon Bowie and Mr. Mark Rice. And Mark, this takes me back to a long time ago when we used to spend some time together. And I thought it was very important back then, and I think it's just as important now, that we get this information out to the community. You know, so Mr. Bowie, I was asking Mark that the last time there was a prison built, and he couldn't think either, but it's Boscoville, I think, was the last one. Oh, MSDF in Milwaukee, is that the last one they built?
I don't know if MSDF will qualify as a prison.
Right.
I think that MSDF is similar to like the House of Corrections out in Franklin, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
They have individuals who can serve more than a year. It's important that we, again, be accurate in that, you know, individuals who go to prison, that means you have been sentenced to 1 year and 1 day.
Right.
So if it's 1 day over that, that's when you go to the state of Wisconsin Department of Corrections.
But MSDF has had people a lot longer than a year.
Absolutely. So that's why it's one of those hybrid models that tend to defy the law a little bit.
Right.
They can hold individuals there and actually sentence people there for longer than that as well. But I think the last prison, if I'm not mistaken, it's either Red Granite or Stanley. Wasn't it one of them?
But the point is, it's rare.
Oh, absolutely. It's been 25 years, right?
Yeah. So
20 years.
So the question becomes, why now? Why does there need to be this new prison built, state-of-the-art prison built? And those of us who are a little more astute than others when it comes to these types of things knows that politics engaged and involved in it, and business is engaged and involved in it. And it's not so much that it's because we have so many people, but opportunities are all tied into that to make money. And so when money has more value and is more important than people, we get these kinds of things. And I'm sure that in the political discussions of the Senate debate that some of those things may come up.
Well, I think that the first thing that we have to do is this is what I've always done. When I'm arguing a case, I try to always figure out what the opposition thinks.
Right.
And then once I realize what they think, then I can formulate a plan for addressing that. So let's see why the opposition would say that we need to have more prisons in Green Bay. Well, the Green Bay Correctional Institution is definitely outdated. It's a relic. It's antique. And most importantly, the cells are approximately 5 feet wide, and you have two individuals inside those cells. So under no circumstances should grown men be in a cell where you can touch both sides of the wall. That's number one. And number two, when you look at the actual institution, it does not have the necessary amenities that a modern prison would have. So they would say that it's actually to the benefit of the prisoners if we were to have a new facility. Now, to me, I could very easily debunk that by stating that the easiest way to do this would be to release some of those prisoners, or most importantly, instead of the one-third individuals who go to prison each year, and as Mark pointed out, it's between 3,000 to 5,000 people who have not committed a new crime, you would be able to close the Green Bay facility because it houses approximately 1,000 individuals. So we're talking about if you just stopped sending people to prison who have not committed a crime, you would have more than enough room in the rest of the Department of Correction to house those prisoners and a couple of thousand less. So that's how I would address that. The issue from the opposition, if you will, who would be promoting that. But there's this one line, right, from Scarface, and I always quote this line, and it's where he tells Tony Montana, he says, listen, never underestimate the other guy's greed.
Yeah.
And I think what we do a lot is we underestimate the other guy's greed. There is a significant amount of money that goes into building a prison. And it's not just for the people who are building it. It is for the community
right.
in which that prison resides. So we must stop underestimating the other guy's greed.
You know,
that way I think we can address this.
You know, the fact that there are so many inmates nationally as well as locally who are of the age that they don't present a threat to anybody, right? I mean, things that just don't make any sense. And ill and all of those things, but we, for whatever reason, we won't release them. The added cost of treating, septuagenarians and octogenarians who are imprisoned, and then it just makes no sense whatsoever. We aren't willing to look at it with open eyes, right? I mean, because, well, they committed the crime, they've got to be there. I mean, so there are some things that can be done, as you stated, Mr. Bowie, that can reduce prison population still. It's bad enough that you got all these young people who are going to be locked up, a whole new crop, if you will, of young people who can be locked up for decades, and some in some instances are going to be working in prisons, right? I mean, a business.
Yeah. It's a huge business. Oh, I'm sorry, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, so I feel we need to start with the humanization of people who are incarcerated. We definitely need to stop using terms like inmate, felon, offender, predator, and instead recognize the humanity of these individuals and start using terms like people who've been incarcerated, formerly incarcerated people, people-centered language, but to start to recognize the potential. There's a huge amount of potential that's wasted. People, some of the best and brightest people I've ever met were in prison or people who are formerly incarcerated. Sharon, for example, some of the most brilliant people that you'll ever meet in your life, and they could be out here contributing to building safer, stronger, and healthier communities, but instead are just trapped in the prison system. And another piece is compassionate release. We saw during COVID that there was no plan to protect the dignity and well-being of people during pandemics. Even during hurricanes and things of that nature in New Orleans, they had plans to protect and save cats and dogs, but there was no plan to protect human beings. And so it starts there. We need to look at that compassionate release and really looking at and respecting the humanity and dignity of people who are incarcerated.
So I got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Mark Rice and Mr. Sharon Bowie are here. And really, Jess, man, I have to tell both of you guys, your stories are inspirational. And in your case, Mr. Bowie, transformational. And I will say to the both of you, your stories just have to be magnified. Mr. Bowie, how do young boys who right now, like the ones that I deal with and see everywhere, who don't think it's, they don't have an idea of what it is to be incarcerated, but yet they hear people giving them all these ideas and hey, it's not so bad. You know, when I talk with young boys about it, they say, well, you know, my friends are, I'll see my friends there. And so, you know, it's not so bad. My brother's there and my cousins are there and my dad is there. You know, some of the saddest things I've ever heard was, one of the saddest things I've ever heard was from a young boy who told me, I reconnected with my dad in prison. But my grandfather's in prison. The acceptance of it. Now, as you guys stated, it's not the end of the world, but it is for far too many. You guys are the exception, not the rules. So for all those other souls that are impacted and affected, man, how, you know, for every one of you guys who makes it out, I don't know, there are hundreds who don't. So how do we affect them, Mr. Bowie? How do, you know, what's at the end of their stories?
Well, I tend to believe that when you're dealing with something that is extremely complicated, you look for a simple answer,
right.
Occam's razor. Let's just cut right through it. And the first thing that we have to do, and that I think that we have gotten away from, is we need to teach our youngsters a respect for the law. Now, the law in and of itself is not corrupt. It's people who are corrupt in the enforcement of the law. And, you know, and I'm not going to proselytize or preach or anything like that, but, you know, I'm a big big fan of Paul and the Acts of the Apostle. You know, the law lets me know what I can and cannot do.
Right.
So from that foundation, then I began to discover what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. I think so many of our young people are just like kites in the wind, just flowing on the breeze. They have no idea that. And as you pointed out, sir, earlier in our discussions, the individuals who are in prison, they don't know they can get their child support frozen. They don't know that they can file a motion for sentence modification. So let's start off with the simplest thing, the easiest thing, the quickest thing that we can do. And that is, one, teach a respect and a knowledge of the law. And once we do that, then other things will just will flow. That's what I believe.
Well, so let me say this, because my good friend, Darrell Williams, Dr. Darrell Williams,
yes,
who is a candidate for United States Senate, yes, is on the line. I don't have to tell anybody how much I admire this man, and I've had him on many times. But let's do this, Connor. Let's just bring Dr. Williams on. Let's just bring him on. Hey, Dr. Williams, how you doing, sir?
Hey, good morning, Mr. Ingram. Just sitting up and listening, Mr. Bowie, and I just wanted to chime in and just tell you what a wonderful job this man is doing over at Marquette, working with our population that's been touched by incarceration. I had the opportunity to speak over there and actually ran into one of my former students while I was there. And this is the work that our community needs. We talk about it, but Mr. Bowie and his team are actually being about the work and doing just a tremendous job over there and keeping them in school so they can become more contributing members of society. So this is the work that we must continue and support throughout this community. Just wanted to let you know that.
You know, Dr. Williams, just had the pleasure of meeting this extraordinary man, and right away the first thing that came to my mind is we need to have him speak with our children over at the...
No question about it. Yeah. No question about it. He can put it in his... He's an outstanding individual, veteran, with a capital IT.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Doc, thank you very much as always, man. Really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. You know, guys, I still think that we must stop children from going in that direction, right?
Amen.
It is always easier to give direction and guidance to young people early in life than to try to transform them or turn them around. That's with any human being. There are cases of successes, as I stated before, but we've got so many young people who we know are headed in the wrong direction. And we have a system that won't do what's necessary for prevention. That's what frustrates me the most, right? You know, children who schools can't read. If you really understood the sheer numbers of children who can't read, right? We know they're poisoned by leaded water. We know the things that happen that set them on a path of destruction. And we won't address those things, right? We won't spend any money on that. It's almost as if we... As you guys well know, by the time a child reaches a certain age in our society, they can tell how many beds they're going to need ahead of time for locking people up. That makes no sense whatsoever to me, right? It's either defeatist attitude or it is a to me, immoral way of looking at life. If your plan is to plan out the fact that you know ahead of time that young people are going to jail, to me that's a satanic way of looking at things, Mark. And we just got to change that. We can do that.
Absolutely. And definitely it's a cycle in so many communities. I think at the heart of it is structural racism. So we definitely need to look at the and take action around the huge racial disparities and structural racism that we're seeing is so deeply embedded in places like Milwaukee.
So you talked about the racial disparities. There are plenty of people listening to this right now who don't believe that.
Well, we can see that just there's definitely Mr. Bowie can also speak to this, but definitely we can see racially disparate outcomes when we look at crimeless revocations, for example. It's just one example where we know that black folks are being sentenced and sent to prison at a hugely disproportionate rate, and for the same types of behaviors that white people under supervision, same technical violations. So there's, for example, 6% of people in the state identify as black, but 40% of people being sent back to prison for crimeless revocations are black. There's also huge disparities in arrests and convictions for marijuana possession. So some things like that where we're seeing these huge racial disparate income outcomes.
So, you know, Mark, mm-hmm. nobody can argue with the 6% of the state being black and 42% of the people, the statistics you just, regurgitated.
Right.
Man, that should wake up anybody who should, if right. they're not biased, and say, well, something is happening here. Mm-hmm. That large a percentage of those being, revocated, over 42%, and you only make up 5 to 6% of the state. That's the answer right there. That something is not right.
Absolutely, and you can go back to some of the root causes like joblessness. When you look at you can see the, like I said before, Wisconsin still detains black men at a higher rate than any other state in the United States. There's a huge disparity there. And just when you look at Milwaukee, for example, over half of black men do not have jobs in Milwaukee. So those, we got to get back to the justice reinvestment idea where we're making these investments up front and reimagining how we're making investments. Like you said, investing in public schools up front. So we brought up the huge numbers, the huge amount of resources being spent on the Department of Corrections on maintaining building prisons over the years. Imagine if instead we were using that to invest in public schools, affordable, stable housing.
Man, people should ask the question, have the African-American males in Milwaukee unemployed? And yet you heard a year ago Donald Trump saying and other Republicans saying, it's the lowest unemployment rate for African-American males in the history of the country. But he wasn't counting. You can say whatever it is you want to say, but those who live in the city know different. And all the time that they were touting that, I was always saying, not Milwaukee. I live in Milwaukee. I see what's going on. Listen, we got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll take a caller, 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to the last few minutes of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. You know, man, these are the kind of shows that I love. I want to, ahead of time, thank you, Mr. Sharon Bowie. And I know we'll be doing this again and again and again. And thank you, as always, my good friend Mark Rice. Let's go to the phone lines and CJ. CJ, you say what?
Thank you for taking my call, Earl, and appreciate your guests. It's an interesting topic. I would like to inject that the family structure and what if your guests grew up without a father in the home and what they think contributes, what percentage of kids end up incarcerated due to that fact. And what percentage of kids today grow up without a father in the home is, what I've been told, over double what it used to be in the 70s. So I think the family structure is where it should begin, with the parents, and including having, I was blessed to have my dad in the home, and I would like to hear their response to that, because I think that's the biggest problem with the incarceration problem. So I'd be interested to hear their answer.
Thank you very much for the call. Mr. Bowie?
Thank you for that question. Actually, I was going to touch on that a little bit later on in this discussion, so we'll just bring it to the forefront now. There is no question, none whatsoever, that socialization is significantly responsible for a number of individuals, we'll say, going down that wrong path, if you will. And one of the ways in which you influence socialization is to have a mother and a father in the home. We know that that traditional paradigm does have an effect on how children grow up, what they believe, what their values are, what their ethics are. We absolutely know that. However, there is no such thing as a panacea principle. And I think where we get off track is we assume that if we do this one thing, that will solve everything. And it won't, because just like there are individuals who go to prison who don't have fathers, well, there are plenty of individuals in prison who were raised with fathers. So it goes back to what Mr. Ingram was saying earlier. How do we get in front of this problem, including those individuals, for those individuals who don't have fathers, as well as those individuals who do have problems? The family structure is important, but there are other societal structures which are just as important, in my opinion, and we need to try and gird up each one of those structures independently, individually, and collectively.
Mr. Rice?
I would say that mass incarceration tears families apart and drains resources that could instead be used to build healthier communities and to keep families together. So we need to look at where we're making these investments up front, and also look at where there's over-policing. I think we got to look at that, where some communities are targeted by police at disproportionate rates. There's definitely racial profiling that's definitely happening. We know that there's the disparities within arrests is partly where it's starting. And on the back end, too, when you're disrupting families through crimeless revocations, whether it's up front for the first time or on the back end, sending people back for technical violations, that's having an impact on the family. It's causing stress and trauma within that family. And sometimes it can be taking out the primary earner or one of the earners in a family. So it can create worse outcomes for children who are going to be faced with that situation without having the father in the home, and creating even a more devastating outcome. So we got to definitely look at how that, and some have described mass incarceration as a slow motion form of genocide of Black people. And so we got to look at systematically how this is being done and how it's been intentional. Look at the historical racism and how the racism has evolved over time, from slavery to Jim Crow to the new Jim Crow, and now what some are even calling the newest form of Jim Crow, where they're expanding to electronic monitoring, GPS monitoring, where communities, some are going to be disproportionately targeted and being under this new form, where they're in some areas starting to decarcerate, but still keeping a system of mass surveillance where people are all under these electronic monitoring devices, which is a new form of oppression. And so something I would definitely recommend reading Michelle Alexander's work on that, who's done a great job of documenting that and making the case about how structural racism is at the heart and center of this, a central factor in all of it.
You know, guys, there's still this belief, even in 2022, that you used to hear it in the 1970s and 80s. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. Cliche. And there are people who still recite that. You say what to those people?
Well, I'm going to say this. In my opinion, the punishments themselves are ridiculous. Therein lies the problem. When you sentence someone to 40 years for a burglary or
that's ridiculous.
That's just outrageous.
Or property, you know.
Sir, let me give you one quick example that just outraged me. When I was at Red Granite Correctional Institution, there was a 16-year-old boy on the basketball court. And I used that pronoun deliberately. He was a 16-year-old child. And I went to him and I said, "Why are you here at Red Granite, you know, with these grown people?" And he told me that he had been arrested for statutory rape. He was sent to prison, given a 10-year sentence for having sex with his 17-year-old girlfriend. Now, I didn't believe this, of course, until I looked at his case personally. They sent a 16-year-old child to prison for 10 years for having sex with his 17-year-old girlfriend. So this is an example, and you may say this is an isolated case, but it is not. So the punishments in and of themselves are ridiculous. And so that cliche, that mantra, you can't do the time, you can't do the crime, well, it's outrageous on its face. Because individuals can do the time, but let the time be appropriate. There is such a thing as responsibility. There is such a thing as you needing to atone for specific behaviors. There needs to be that. You know, those are the three legs on that stool of restorative justice. There needs to be atonement, but let the atonement fit the crime before you ask someone to do the time.
You know, Mark, in these last few minutes, where is the debate going to be held?
It will be at Mount Zion Baptist Church in Milwaukee, just off of 2nd and North in Milwaukee. Again, that's Thursday, July 21st, starting at 8:15 p.m. U.S. Senate Candidate Forum, hosted by Wisdom.
Is it open to the public?
It's definitely open to the public. We want to get as many folks as possible. We want a great turnout there. And definitely we'll be hearing where they stand on some of these issues that we talked about today, and then definitely be working to hold them accountable after.
And we would be remiss if we didn't ask the process and why our good friend Dr. Darrell Williams was not included.
So Wisdom decided to invite only candidates who were polling at 5% or above in the latest Marquette University poll, and that's process. I definitely feel like it would be great in another format to hear from all the candidates. I'm definitely interested in learning more, but that was how Wisdom decided to go with it at this particular forum.
Hey, thank you very much, Mark, as always, man. Now that we've reconnected, we'll do this again and again and again. I want to thank you, Mr. Bowie. It has been an honor and a privilege to have interaction with you, your vast knowledge of what this subject is, and your experience puts you on a high level, and people need to hear from you. And I'm going to reach out to you to see if we can get you to come talk to these young boys that we have. That's going to happen. But thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Connor. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Everybody, see you later.